From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about the Indianapolis Opera's new holiday tradition.
I get to chat with Michael Feinstein about his new book, The Gershwins and Me.
And I'll get a very cool preview of the James Dean exhibit at the State Museum. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Opera has begun a new tradition for the winter holidays, and Sharon Gamble invited Artistic Director James Carrer to our studios to learn about Amal and the Night Visitors and more.
You have a variety of heroes slash villains this season. Was that the thematic lens through which you were looking as you chose this season?
Yes and no. I mean, they all came about through various reasons, but then once we saw how they all fit together, it wasn't a bad idea to play up that angle. But just given the climate these days, everybody's trying to be a little more creative and inventive rather than just doing the same old butterfly Aida Bohème. So whether we use our new opera center, the Baselli Opera Center, or do something a little off the beaten path at Clues Hall, or looking for new collaborators, as we're doing with our middle piece with IU, they all seemed to hit this year, and there was a reason for doing each, but they really had nothing to do with each other. But
sure,
in the totality of the whole thing, it turned out well.
Nice contrast.
Yes.
For people who are not familiar with Amal and the Night Visitors, tell us the story of how the country first saw this opera.
I'm not sure what Mr. Menotti, what intrigued him into doing this, but it was first performed in 1951, so it's been around a while in the scheme of opera, not that long, but it's still fairly recent. And it was television was just starting to take off as a medium.
And he was going to revolutionize us and make us so much better educated and more cultured.
Yeah,
right?
And it was that's when I grew up. So between early things and Bernstein's Young People's Concerts, there seemed to be a lot more of classical art being put on television to try it out and see how well it fared. And this really was written for television. That's why it's only an hour long, because it had to fit within
right,
an hour.
Right.
Yeah, for the TV producers. So that's in the scale of it, the size of the orchestra, and the number of people. It was done for a television studio. So,
and also because of the compact nature and the subject matter, meant to appeal to people of all ages, including children, right?
Absolutely. It's got, Amal is a young boy, so it's, I think kids like to see someone their own age on stage. So it was appealing in that fashion. But it's a story that, whether you're religious or not, it's about giving. So it has a religious bent to it, obviously, the three kings on their way to, Bethlehem. But that's sort of the vehicle for the story. It's not the story in itself. It's meeting this little boy, the crippled boy, and then what the meeting does to he and his mother and where they go from there.
And this is, the intention is for this to be an annual event.
We really hope so. We've been looking for a Christmas project now for a number of years, but there aren't many out there to choose from, and without reinventing the wheel, this is something that's always been in the back of my mind, but until we actually had the Baselli Opera Center, that was a theater or a facility that was of a scale that worked for this, we really didn't have any place in particular. But once that became ours, and we've already produced there for two seasons now, again, it was just a logical next step. We've always wanted to do a Christmas opera project, and we had the facility and the place to do it. So it finally, all those years of wishing and wanting fell into place.
Just had to be patient. Now, I know that in your career you've worked with singers of all ages and performers of all ages. Is there anything that you have to do differently working with children?
It's funny you ask that. When I first approached Henry Leck at the Children's Choir, both of our boys are in the program, and the first one that came about was a suggestion from Henry. I went to one of their rehearsals, and he had meet Noah and went down to his studio, and he sang, and we talked, and that's how it came about. And afterwards, I asked Henry, I said, is there anything I need to know about working with children? And he said, no, nope, especially with somebody like Noah. He said, he's a great musician. Treat him just like you would an adult.
Wow.
So
what a great gift to you.
It's been great. And I've probably been erring a little on the softer side. And because it's been strung out, the one thing with a child who isn't a professional, he has school and he's in the children's choir and he plays cello. So he's got a lot on his plate.
Sure.
So I can't expect every lesson to come in with a big chunk learned, or it's been a longer, slower process, but he's really been on top of it, and he's very bright and very quick. But we've tried to keep it as easygoing and comfortable and gentle as possible. But in the last couple of sessions we've had together, he'll sing through something, and I don't feel shy about asking him to try it differently or play with this, or sing a little louder there, or point out this word, and and tell him things like, you realize this isn't just stand and sing like you do in choir. You're going to have to act and make him.
Did that scare him?
I think it intrigues him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say scared is necessarily the right word, but he's a little apprehensive about how all this is going to work because he's never done anything like that. But when I ask him to do things, it's kind of fun. We'll take a page or so, and I'll say, okay, now forget that there's music and just read it to me like a play.
Oh.
So we'll read lines back and forth. I said, that's not very dramatic. I said, think Shakespearean. Make it bigger, louder. Be more mischievous. Be more something.
Think what this person would actually be feeling.
And he does well. Yeah. You have to prod him and you prime the pump a little bit, but he gets it. So I don't anticipate any problems, but it's made me think about those sorts of things in a different way. We're working with probably the rest of the cast, who are all seasoned opera vets. I won't have to think along those lines. I just come in and say, do this, do that, and louder, be funnier, change your pacing timing. So I don't have to explain myself. We can just give directions and go from there. But with someone who's never done it before in that age, it's made me have to rethink some things, even though Henry did just say, treat him like an adult.
For somebody who hasn't heard the music to Amahl, how would you describe it?
It's very tuneful. I mean, I know a lot of people are afraid of 20th century singing and music altogether, and this is really very listenable. And both the kids and their voice teacher, and I, even though I've heard this over a number of years, I've got these tunes stuck in my head just as if it were Mozart or Verdi or any other opera composer. It's the kind you do go out humming, and recognizable tunes. So it has moments that have harmonies in the orchestra that may be a little bit what someone might call 20th century or contemporary, but it's really minimal. And most of it's very tuneful and easygoing and lyric. And like I said, you'll go home humming the tunes.
Fantastic. And then in the spring, we fast forward a generation. We stay with 20th century opera, but it's much later, 1983, right?
Right.
For Philip Glass's Akhenaten, am I saying
correct?
That correctly?
Yes, perfect.
And this was the third in a trilogy. He was writing about science. He was writing about politics. And in this case, he was writing about religion, right? So he wrote an opera about Einstein, an opera about Gandhi, and this about
ancient Egypt. Yes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's the father of King Tut, if my memory doesn't fail me, my research is accurate. But it's a really interesting story because it's the father of King Tut, but he was the one who tried to bring one god religion to ancient Egypt instead of a slew of gods. And he actually succeeded in changing the whole religious culture at that point.
A single person in one generation
just
did this.
Just a monotheistic in his lifetime.
Wow.
And he converted everybody, convinced them, and then sort of shut himself away in his ivory tower. And little by little, people became disillusioned by the whole thing and went back, overthrew him, went back. And as I understand, in all the hieroglyphs now in Egypt, he's been obliterated from their history. We know about him, but they were so upset after the fact that they chiseled off his name and all his writings and things from the columns and the hieroglyphs.
Well, that does have so opera written all over it.
He accomplished a lot and
conflict.
Then was almost as quickly forgotten and tried to be pushed out of history.
Wow.
By his contemporaries.
Wow.
So, and that's kind of how the opera, what the story is about.
Mm-hmm.
Convincing people that this is a good path to take and then closing ranks around himself and being isolated to the point where it becomes a problem.
A lot of people are more familiar with Philip Glass's instrumental music than vocal and choral music. Is it similar, or how would you describe it?
I would say it's similar. I mean, he has a style that's, to me, kind of recognizable. It's very repetitive. Sounds like a bad way to use it. I don't know this piece as well as I do Satyagraha, the one that's about Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was around in upstate New York when that came out, so I saw it at Art Park and City Opera, and the man who played Gandhi is actually from Indianapolis.
Oh, my gosh.
Douglas Perry, who sung with us a bunch, but he was Gandhi in the original. So I know that piece probably better than I do this one. But it's as I said, it almost lulls you to sleep at times. There are chants and things that go, and in the orchestra parts, it'll give you a pattern and say, play it for 122 times.
You have to be good at counting.
So, and matter of fact, I won't give a name, but a conductor friend of mine who is unfortunately no longer with us conducted the premiere of that. And he had done it so many times, he would start watching. And he got to some point in the middle of a performance and looked down at the first violin and said, where are we?
Oops.
And the violinist was a little bored with the whole thing. And he looked back up and said, that's your job.
Oh, ouch.
And wouldn't tell him.
Oh, snap.
So, I mean, it does have built-in problems.
But what I love about the way Philip Glass builds phrases is he repeats and repeats and repeats, and then there's a tiny change. There's a one-note change. And and just when you think you're going to hear it for the, thousandth time or 50th time or 20th time, there's a slight modification, a slight evolution. It just keeps going.
Yeah. So. And it's neat. I'm very curious to see how IU, who's our collaborator
on
this.
Yeah, talk about that collaboration.
How they stage it.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, we had this conversation not too long ago in the office, because our last piece of the season is Wagner, and he changed the path of opera with the Bayreuth, putting the orchestra underneath and the scale of things in length and mythology and history. And in some ways, Philip Glass has done the same thing for this next generation, just the way the orchestra and his style of composition, with the repetitiveness, and then all of a sudden something different. It lulls you into a sense of comfort and then, rocks your boat a little bit.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be very curious to see how that's translated into the theater and the staging. We had a meeting at IU, I guess it was a couple of months ago now, to see the presentation of the stage director and the set designer and their plans. And it hadn't been, the blueprints hadn't been drawn yet, but the projection of what it was going to look like in the drawings and the costumes, and it was all incredibly fascinating. So I'm as anxious to see that as I am to hear the music and see how that side turns out. But it's a total art or music theater piece. And in some ways, to just listen to the music isn't fair to the piece. So I wouldn't recommend someone to get a recording and just go sit down and listen to it cold. If you can find a DVD or see a production, I think that would give you a better feel for how the totality works. Because one without the other is unfair.
Yeah. And that's a good point. And as much as we public radio stations in particular are guilty of playing recordings of opera music so that a lot of listeners know the music before they see the opera, and that's actually not the right way. Not that I'm imposing rule,
right,
but it's so much better if your first experience is not just the oral,
right?
Because
that
oral
really,
and the visual.
Yeah, that really is only half of the picture when you go to the theater. So, and I have to say, the older I get, the more interesting I find the theater and the text side of things. And how, because that's really what the composers started with. They started with a text and a theatrical path, and then they set that to music. So in some ways, the music doesn't come secondary, but it's based on something else. So just to listen to the music without knowing what that is, in some ways shortchanges your understanding of the music too, both how it was written and how a certain text is set, whether it's full orchestra or just an oboe, or how the composer heard something. And if you don't know what the storyline, and that's one of the fun things I find working with orchestras as we put operas together, explaining what the theater is. It's not just, I can sit there and say, play this shorter, play this louder. But if I tell them what the story is and what this person's saying, what they're thinking, what they're doing, that in some ways explains it better than just the technical aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah.
If you know why you're doing what you do,
sure.
That all of a sudden makes people play differently, I hope.
And from a listener's viewpoint, how many times have people been driving along and they hear an excerpt from, say, a Mozart opera and people are giggling and you don't know why they're giggling because you've not seen the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, and having seen a lot of these operas before, once you've seen it once or twice, even just once, but the more you've seen it, then for me, it's fun to go listen to the music because I can fill in the rest, either the way I would like to see it or how I remember it in my favorite version or just
how you'll conduct it the next time.
The way you know it can be, but you fill in that aspect. It's like reading a book.
Sharon Gamble with James Carrer, Artistic Director of the Indianapolis Opera. You can see the IO's family-friendly season opener, A Mall and the Night Visitors, December 5th through December 16th at the Basile Opera Center. Learn more at indieopera.org. That's indyopera.org.
Singer, pianist, and music historian Michael Feinstein was just 20 years old when he got the opportunity to work for Ira Gershwin. Feinstein's new book is about the 6 years working as Gershwin's archivist, but it's also a history of the Gershwin brothers' contribution to the Great American Songbook as told through 12 songs. Travis DiNicola spoke with Feinstein, who's also the artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, about his new book.
Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. It is truly a pleasure to have you in our studio.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And congratulations on the new book. Absolutely beautiful. Obviously, a work of love.
Yes, I'm very pleased with the way it turned out. It is, in its own way, lavish. It was fun to be involved in choosing all the different kinds of images and the color and the kind of paper stock mm-hmm. to create something that would be appropriate for the era in which I've written about the Gershwins.
A great gift for music lovers, I would think. Just a really lovely book that you've put together. But let me ask you this. There's so many wonderful stories, and of course they're organized around the 12 different songs that you've selected. But how did you first get connected with Ira Gershwin? You were 20 years old, is that right? When you
yes.
first met him or started working with him?
Yes, I was 20. I'd moved to Los Angeles from Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. and I was trying to find my way as a performer, and I also was a record collector, and I went into a used record store in Hollywood called The Record Collector and was looking for a record by Oscar Levant. The guy who owned the shop had these records that belonged to Levant that had come from an auction of the Levant estate. I bought the records, and then I got the phone number of his widow, whom I called out of the blue, and she was sort of perplexed by this call from this kid, and I went over
sure.
to meet her, and she eventually created an introduction to the Gershwin family after she and I had become friends. So it was quite an amazing sort of circuitous journey that now seems like it was supposed to happen.
I mean, obviously, over the years that you worked with Ira Gershwin, you developed a very close friendship, but meeting him that first time, I mean, that had to be just a little overwhelming for a young kid.
I was very nervous. Ira Gershwin was one of my idols. I was 20. He was 80. He had written the words to all these classic songs that I'd grown up with, and it was amazing that he was still alive because mm-hmm. most of his contemporaries were gone. His brother George died in 1937 at the age of 38. So there I was with this man who I only had read about and I'd seen photos of, and mm-hmm. he was much older than the photos I'd seen of him because he had become reclusive, and suddenly there I was trying to make conversation with him, and I said, Mr. Gershwin, I have a old 78 of Gems from La La Lucille. La La Lucille was the first Broadway musical written by George Gershwin in mm-hmm. 1919. I said, La La Lucille? He said, well, that must contain the two hits of the show, Teotl and Bumbo and Nobody But You. I said, that's right. And his wife, Lee, turned to her sister, who was also sitting there, and said, isn't that cute? He's telling Ira that's right.
So
it started a relationship immediately that Ira saw that I was not your typical kid of that generation.
Sure.
And it was a magnificent experience.
And you basically, over the time, got to work with cataloging his records, his memorabilia. Is that, roughly correct?
Yes.
You did a lot of different work for him over those, I believe it was 6 years, correct?
6 years and 1 month. Mm-hmm. The first job was to catalog his collection of phonograph records.
Okay.
And as I was doing that, I became more or better acquainted with Ira. He would sit there as mm-hmm. I'd go through the records and play them, which would spur his memory to tell me stories and anecdotes. And we became very close very, very quickly. And one day his wife, Lee, came to me and said, "You've given my husband a new lease on life, and I want you to know that you're very important to this household and to him." And she said, "I want you to stay here as long as you can." She said, "I'm going to open up every closet and drawer to just keep yourself busy, and most important, keep my husband happy."
Wow.
So there I was, basically with the purpose of keeping Ira connected and happy mm-hmm. and alive. And it was great for me because I got to go through all the memorabilia in the house, everything, and he would tell me stories about all of it. And to have physical objects to spur the trigger of the memory was mm-hmm. was amazing, because it caused him to recall things that otherwise he might never have been able to think of.
Now, were you taking notes at the time yourself? I mean, were you thinking this is just, you know, of course you're cataloging some great physical artifacts of history, but the stories that he's telling, were you consciously thinking, I need to get this down?
I kept notes at certain times, yeah. and I wish that I had kept more copious notes.
Sure.
Shana Alexander, who was a wonderful author and whose father was a songwriter and close friend of the Gershwins, said, "Oh, you've got to keep a diary." Mm-hmm. And foolishly, I didn't listen and keep a regular diary. However, there were times where I did record sessions with Ira when we would go through music, and when I brought the great songwriter Harry Warren over to see Ira, I recorded that for some reason. So there's a lot of memorabilia and recordings and such that I was able to go back to help me create my book.
Well, there's a lot of moments in the book where it feels like you're right there in the room with you and Ira. I mean, it's really enjoyable to read. I got to say that the chapter that I think I probably enjoyed the most, I have been just loving reading the book, is the one on I've Got a Crush on You. I love that song anyway. And you tie it in so nicely at the time period with Rhapsody in Blue. And so much of the chapter is, in fact, about Rhapsody in Blue and then sort of and other songs of that time period. Tell me a bit about that, because that's, of course, I mean, when people hear of the Gershwins, that's Rhapsody in Blue is one of the first things they think of.
Yes, well, Rhapsody in Blue was written as a piece of special material, if you will, for the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Paul Whiteman gave an interview to a New York newspaper saying that he had this concert coming up, and he said, "Oh, Irving Berlin's writing a piece for us, and George Gershwin's going to write a piece." Neither of which was true. And George Gershwin read this in the paper and called up Whiteman and said, "What are you talking about?" And Whiteman said, "Well, yeah, I told you someday I'd like you to write something." He said, "Why don't you just write it?" So George said, "Okay, well, I'll give it a shot." So it was that casual. And George wrote this piece over a period of 3.5 weeks, which was very quickly orchestrated by Ferdy Groffé, who was Paul Whiteman's orchestrator. And on February 12, 1924, it was part of this concert at Aeolian Hall called An Experiment in Modern Music.
Okay.
And the piece was premiered. And among all the other works in this very, very long concert, Rhapsody was second from the end. It created this this furor that was unprecedented, and the concert was attended by everyone from Rachmaninoff to Heifetz and all the important musicians of the day. And suddenly, this piece that was written as a specialty for the Paul Whiteman dance band became the shot heard around the world. And shortly thereafter, the concert was repeated at Carnegie Hall and a dozen times after that, and then George's publisher, who published all his popular songs, decided to publish it. And when George told Ira that they were going to publish Rhapsody in Blue, Ira said, well, who's going to buy it? Because it was such an odd thing. It was a 15-minute piece for piano and orchestra. I mean, who was going to play that? But, of course, it turned out to be the most popular piece of American music written in the 20th century.
You know, just listening to you right now, I said that it was, sometimes in reading the book, it was like sitting in the room with you and Ira. It's almost like sitting in the room with you and George, if that was possible. I mean, you almost kind of transport yourself back to that time period through Ira's stories. It's as if you were actually back there during the 20s and 30s and such. I mean, that's one of the really enjoyable things about the book. I mean, did you, you know, feel that at times, like that you were almost like time traveling in your conversations with Ira Gershwin?
Well, my whole life feels like that. It does. Yeah. I mean, because I live a duality of being in the present, but also experiencing other time. I guess it's that whole physics thing where you know, time is is everything's happening at once. Yes, it definitely felt like I was in Ira's era, especially because all the artifacts were there still. George's pipe and his tie clip and his little black book with the phone numbers of his girlfriends and his paintings and of course all the working materials. And so it all had an energy and an aura, and to be able to hold a manuscript that was in George's hand and then to find Ira's lyric sheet really gave me a sense of immediacy. Mm-hmm. And the piano that I practiced on every day there was the piano on which George had written written Porgy and Bess. Rhapsody, that piano had, well, there are probably about 25 people I've met through the years who claim to have the piano on which he wrote Rhapsody in Blues.
Sure.
So I don't know where that real one is.
Now, my understanding is you've always been a collector, Michael Feinstein. You've always loved collecting the memorabilia of the music that you love, of the American Songbook. At what point did you start thinking about that this collection had a purpose? And I'm jumping ahead a bit here to the work that you do through the Center of the Performing Arts, Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, and the work you do there with the American Songbook Collection. But, I mean, were you thinking before you had worked with Ira Gershwin or while you were doing that, that, you know, maybe someday this stuff will all be brought together in some sort of, you know, exhibit or collection? Or at what point did that occur to you, that you'd really tapped into something special?
I'll tell you, Travis, the funny thing is that a lot of the stuff that I collected early on, I didn't keep. I had an original contract from Porgy and Bess, which I donated to the Library of Congress very early on, then to discover they already had a copy of it, which was sort of irritating. But I had a huge amount of very rare studio records, Hollywood records, that I also gave to an institution. It wasn't until a number of years after Ira died that I started holding on to things, because I realized that I didn't like what had happened with some of the things that I had passed on to others, and I wanted to make sure that what I had could be appreciated and would be in a situation where others could benefit from it in one way or another. And so the last 20 years is where I started to really focus on it. As time has progressed, more and more so, and as I have collected more and more material, mm-hmm. and then orchestrations and things that take up a great amount of space, then I realized that I needed to find a place or create a place, which I did. I created the Feinstein Initiative, which is headquartered in Carmel, at the offices of the upstairs offices of the Palladium, because I wanted to finally get the stuff out there so other people could experience it.
Tell me a little bit more about your work here in Indiana, in Carmel, with the center. It was very exciting when it was announced that you were going to be the artistic director. It seems like certainly a big part of the appeal was that you could bring your American Songbook collection here. But there's so many other things that you seem to have going on in town. And you've really, and I know you know, live between here and New York and L.A., but it seems like you've really made Carmel and Indianapolis part of your life and your home.
Yes, well, this is where I'm registered to vote.
Okay.
You know, this is home. And the thing that's great about this part of the world, as you know, being involved in the arts, is that there's a certain openness and an appreciation that exists in this community that is unusual to this area. I mean, the fact that Indianapolis has such a thriving arts community, and the city of Carmel, which has created the money to build the Palladium, is rather extraordinary. I mean, there is a great emphasis on the arts, and to give the Palladium an identity connected with the Great American Songbook, I think was a very good idea, because it meant it wasn't just another concert hall, even though what we present there is quite eclectic, and all the different series are wide-ranging with all the...
Recently, I saw Blondie and Devo there.
Exactly.
I mean, who would have thunk that? But.
Yes, and it's fun for me to be able to book acts like that, because I like being on the other side of the process. But the preservation of the songbook, of course, is one of the main focuses, and so having the initiative offices here, I've been able to use the incredible Palladium to have the Great American Songbook competition, and in November we have new applicants from high schools and high school kids all over the country. So having this extraordinary state-of-the-art performing space and the support of the community and the staff is something that is a dream come true. I wouldn't be able to do what I do if it weren't for the people here.
It's really great that it seems like you've gotten a lot out of it and have brought so much as well. tell me a bit about the radio show that you're doing. It just started airing here on WFYI just in the past month. Thrilled that that is on the air. Have you been doing that a while, or is that a new show? I wasn't clear on that.
Song Travels is something that was just created within the last year.
Okay.
We've had our first season, and the second season will start next year. It will be aired next year. And it will eventually be a weekly show that will be on 52 weeks a year, which means that I'm in the studio a great deal of
time. Keeping busy.
Yes, because Song Travels is a show that is 50% music and 50% talk. And the music is often live performances by our guests, which is the distinction of this program, that I wanted to have artists come and play music live. And some are comfortable doing that. Some are not. And in many cases, I'm accompanying the performers or singing duets with them or doing whatever is appropriate for the show.
Yeah.
So it's a great musical challenge for me, and it involves tremendous preparation because I've got to be on my game where I'll get a list of songs just a couple nights before from Jose Feliciano or Gloria Gaynor or whoever saying, I want to do this and that, and I have to practice it and I have to be ready. You know, with Aaron Neville, I was doing these doo-wop songs, and I've done gospel things, and it's been exciting to stretch myself in these other genres because that's the joy of it for me.
That is very exciting, and it is quite a great range, and it sounds like you're just having a fun time with it.
I am. I'm always grateful when it's finished and it's worked out well because it's a lot of pressure. But it has to sound very, but it's also relaxed and fun, so it's that balance.
You know, I want to go back to something you said in the book, and not to change the tone of the conversation too much, but I was a little surprised. And one point near the end of the book, you talk about how that the culture for music and the appreciation of music is different now, and maybe not as strong as you feel like it used to be. Whether that time that it used to be back in the 20s or 30s, or even during the 60s and 70s. But yet, there's so many great musicians and so many different ways of hearing them today. Tell me about what you were thinking when you wrote that in the book.
The communal experience is different. We listen to music in an isolated fashion.
Mm-hmm.
People listen on their iPods. People listen with earphones in their ears. You see people walking down the street and they're no longer engaged in the world because they are lost in their own world listening to music. And that is very different from the communal experience that existed when our country was transformed by particular songs or experiences that music would carry us through. It's an experience that does not exist today.
That shared experience.
The shared experience is different.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have too many songs that everybody knows. Certain people know pop stuff, there's classical, but it is all segmented and fragmented in a way that is the gift of the world today, that people can find any genre they're interested in, but people tend to focus on one thing, and the shared experience is less. Just like with news outlets today, you know, people gravitate to the news outlets that reflect their specific point of view, so we are becoming narrower in our ability to appreciate other points of view. It's the same thing with music.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's the unfortunate part of the world today, that we are not forced to experience something communally, and I think that that is a tremendous loss. Now, I'm not denigrating music today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about the means by which we are becoming more and more isolated from each other as humans, and we are losing the heart experience, and we are losing our common bond of coming together in a way that has separated us politically. I think that the deprivation and lack of arts funding over the last 30 years has directly impacted many of the travails we have in this country. It is so clear to me. And the fact that we have a political system where neither Republicans or Democrats really care about the arts is a tragedy. And when I say really care about the arts, then we don't have a cultural arts ambassador in our country. We don't have anybody that seems to be truly championing the need for arts, because the arts are truly what unify us as a country. And until these fools in the political system realize that we will destroy ourselves without that, we're going to remain in turmoil.
Am I also hearing you say, too, though, the importance of that communal live shared experience as well? I mean, whether it's at a small club, at your club in New York, or here at the Playdom, just bringing people together to experience that, even beyond just, you know, having sort of common themes that people share or common ideas, as you so eloquently put. I mean, that has something to do with it as well, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, the power of coming together.
Yeah.
It's like the power of praying together or doing anything en masse. The power of people focusing on one thing is life-changing. When I do live concerts, it's my favorite thing because it is an experience where everybody is breathing together and everybody's hearts are opened up in the same way, and it is transformative. It is a transformative experience that truly uplifts us and gives us hope and courage to do things in the world. When people leave a great artistic performance, be it ballet or an exhibition of paintings, we feel more creative in our souls. It extends our lives. I mean, the physiological effects of what the arts do are extraordinary, and to see that devalued and unappreciated is just head-scratching to me.
Well, Michael, as a big fan of your live performances that I have seen, it is truly a pleasure to meet you in person and to speak with you live, and I thank you very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with musician Michael Feinstein. Feinstein is the artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Proceeds from the book The Gershwins and Me will benefit the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative, which hosts the only high school vocal academy and competition in the U.S. dedicated solely to the music from Broadway, Hollywood musicals, and the Tin Pan Alley era of the early to mid-20th century. The book and CD can be purchased at the Center for the Performing Arts Basile Gift Shop and at Indie Reads Books.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Happy Thanksgiving. Hey.
I'm stuffed.
Oh, well, we're so stuffed we don't have time for that calendar that we call.
What'll we do? But we'll be back with it next week. See you then. Happy leftovers.
He's been gone for decades, but pilgrims still visit the tiny Indiana town of Fairmount to try to learn the secret to the man who was too fast to live, too young to die, James Dean. The farm boy, known for the smoldering good looks, is the subject of a new exhibition at the Indiana State Museum, and Sharon Gamble, who's made her own journey to Fairmount, invited Associate Curator of Cultural History Catherine Gould and Communications Director Kathy Moore to our studios to learn more.
There's something in every culture, I suspect, but in particular in the United States, and not my armchair philosophy theory is that it's because we're a relatively young country, but we're fascinated by people who have this kind of trajectory. They come from modest roots. They find some sort of fame. They ignite the sky and burn out quickly. Marilyn Monroe is a good example, though she outlived James Dean by a number of years. But what do you think that is? And is there something in this exhibition that helps us understand what is the fascination with this guy?
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to know myself. We all think farm boy moves to Hollywood, becomes a star, and then dies tragically. And there was all this other stuff kind of in there, the fact that he was a serious artist. So all of that got lost with his whole icon idol thing. And I kind of wanted to know why. He made three films. Why are we still talking about him 57 years after his death? And why are we doing an exhibition on him? Three films. So I think part of it is there was a lot of marketing around his image. Eden was the only of his three films that had been released when he died. So Warner Brothers still had two films they needed to market. And so they really played up a lot of that kind of little boy lost image. They knew his background of losing his mother when he was a young child and living separated from his father. So they played upon that. They did a lot to kind of meld James Dean with the character of Jim Stark from Rebel Without a Cause. And really, when you say the name James Dean, that is the image you see, is the red jacket and the blue jeans.
If you say he made three films, to most people will say Rebel Without a Cause
correct.
Dead Air.
Correct. Yeah. So part of it was marketing, is they really kind of put the two together and promoted him as this, you know, little boy lost, this young rebel, and then played up on the sympathy of lost potential. He was this budding star, I think rightfully. He did get posthumous Academy Award nominations for Eden and Giant. So the legitimate talent was there. And so as part of this promotion effort, they definitely played up that, the lost potential, you know, how sad that was. So I think that all of that has been at play for the last five decades. And then coupled with it, I think there is a genuine attraction to who he was as a person for the true fans, who can see beyond all the marketing into who James Dean was as a person and as an artist. So really, I just don't think he's ever quite disappeared over the last 57 years. And I think new generations of fan keep rediscovering him first through the films and then as they get to know who he was as a person. With more research and investigating, he's just someone that they have an appreciation for how he lived his life. So I think part of it is, you know, marketing and commercialism. But then I think there is a genuine fan base who appreciate him as an artist.
There is a sense that, you know, I'm thinking, I don't remember seeing photos of him smiling. There are all those iconic images where he's and maybe the photographer said, look smoldering.
Cool.
Look
not,
cool.
Can't look cool when you're
look
grinning.
Look hip. Right. That's right. That was a calculated attempt on the part, as you say, of the marketing folks in the film industry. What are some of the pieces of this exhibition? What will people be able to see?
Well, there's over 70 artifacts from the film, or for the exhibit. Some of Hermit's personal life, like his baby shoes, some
aww.
Baby clothing. Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yep. There's his birth announcement from 1931. Some of his high school memorabilia. He was a big athlete in high school, which a lot of people don't know. He was a leading scorer on the basketball team at the Fairmount High School. So a lot of personal stuff and a lot of professional stuff. Artifacts, some props from the films. We are borrowing costume pieces of ooh. His from Warner Brothers for each of the three films. So the artifacts really kind of run him his life from infancy up until shortly before his death. And then a lot of graphics. There's a lot of professional graphics taken by some of the photographers of the day, Dennis Stock, Roy Schott, Frank Worth, Sid Avery. And those are the formal professional ones that we all recognize. And then also a lot of family snapshots, some more candid images, him as a kid on the farm, and then later as an adult, just kind of in his everyday life. So one of the attempts of the exhibition was to kind of take that professional image that we know of him through the graphics and then add context through the artifacts, the kind of the actual life bits of James Dean.
Kathy, you mentioned the car. We should talk about the car, and we should talk about what happened to James Dean.
Well, it didn't happen in that car, first of all. The car...
That would be really creepy.
The car that we have is just the most... probably one of the most awesome cars I've ever seen. I was in love with it the day it arrived at the museum. And it was the car that he drove to his senior prom. It was his dad's car, right, Catherine?
His uncle's car.
His uncle's car.
And what was it?
It's a red 1949 Ford. And so he borrowed it from his uncle to take his date to the prom.
Sweet.
So
it was a small car for its time, probably. You know, they didn't have different models of cars. They didn't have Mustangs in 1949,
sure.
You know, Fairlanes, whatever. They just had a Ford. It was a Ford custom something, but it's probably smaller than most cars of its day. But it is in, someone has babied this car for 50
aww.
Some years. It is a gorgeous car. And so that'll be on display.
So I am curious, like many others, mm-hmm. I have made the pilgrimage to Fairmount to be there, to breathe the air James Dean mm-hmm. breathed 5-6 decades before. Are there a lot of family members? Are there very many family members left? And were they a resource for you for putting this together?
Yes, I've been working directly with the family. They are still in Fairmount.
Still farming?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they are. Very lovely, lovely, lovely individuals. We've been working with them on both borrowing the artifacts and also the graphics. We've been working directly with the James Dean Estate to do this exhibition. So they've been wonderfully helpful. A lot of the artifacts we're also borrowing from the Fairmount Historical Museum. They've been wonderful partners in this. So the community of Fairmount has been very helpful in this, in making sure the exhibition is successful.
What was the trigger to put this exhibition together?
Representatives, some of the legal representatives of his estate had been to the museum when we had the Charity for All Abraham Lincoln exhibition a couple of years ago, and then they had seen the Titanic exhibition that we had hosted, and they liked what they saw. And so they actually contacted us and said, hey, we have access to this material. Would you be interested in maybe doing something with it? So we took a look at the material, which was a very large treasure trove of graphics, photographs, original photographs, and then also the artifacts. We met with the family and said, yeah, there's an exhibit here. There's good material, there's good resources for us to use, and I think we can tell a really good story.
I don't mean to be premature, but is there a chance this might travel?
I don't think so. A lot of the artifacts are usually on exhibit in Fairmount.
Got it.
So they'll be returned to the museum up there.
Sure.
The name of the exhibit is Eternal James Dean, and he lives on. I mean, the photos in this exhibit are fascinating to me because they're so timeless. There is an iconic image of him that we have been using in our marketing and things like that. And if you look at the image, his clothing, his hairdo, his everything about him, it could be today. Mm-hmm. It is so timeless. So it's just kind of fascinating to see that he is still extremely appealing and sexy, you know, to look at those pictures. It doesn't look like, oh, he was really sexy back in the day, but give me a break on that hair.
Right,
you know, it's
exactly.
Not like that.
Correct.
It is so timeless. And I think that there is a fascination with that because, and that's why Catherine named it Eternal James Dean, I think, because it really hasn't changed. You know, he was frozen in time. You never saw him age. You never saw him get married and have little bratty kids and
never
get divorced. And, you know,
inexpensive wine on a TV commercial or whatever.
Yes. He froze at that perfect time.
He never disappointed us, you know.
Right.
He never had those failed marriages or, you know, the trips to rehab.
Substance abuse problems,
yep.
Sure.
And when I, just a few months ago, February 8th, he would have been 81 years old.
Oh, my gosh. I was purposely trying not to do the math in
my
head.
He's an Aquarius.
Oh. And I just think, you know, you can't picture an 81-year-old James Dean.
You can't.
No.
And I'm kind of glad.
You don't want to either.
He is, his image is eternal. His attitude, his, just kind of everything about him. I know some people, when they find him today, they think, oh, that's so cliche, but you know, cliche and stereotypes start somewhere.
He did start it. I think he did start it. He was the original cool. He was cool before Elvis.
Elvis was 56.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was cool before anybody was cool. Mm-hmm. He kind of started all that.
So when you look at, you know, people like Johnny Depp today, and you can trace all of that back to James Dean and that kind of nonchalant attitude, mm-hmm. Not caring for convention. That was a big deal in 1955. Today, it's kind of, another actor. In 1955, it was quite original.
But you're right. Cliches and stereotypes start somewhere.
Leave it to Beaver time and think what else was going on in 1955. He was so anti.
Yeah, looking at 1955 is an interesting year. I mean, we had James Dean kind of emerge on the scene. But it was also the same year that Disneyland opened in Hollywood.
Hmm.
And the Mickey Mouse Club debuted on TV. It was the same year of Gunsmoke and the Honeymooners. So 55 was a really interesting year in terms of American popular culture.
Yeah.
Things were changing. That rock and roll song? I'm blanking on the name. The film The Blackboard Jungle, mm-hmm. which was released, I think, in March of 55, was the first film to use a rock and roll song as a theme song.
Oh.
Hmm.
And that I bet there were lots of backroom battles to get that to happen.
Yep. It was new. It was risque.
Yeah. Producers probably were doing that cost benefits analysis of how many people will be offended by this.
Correct. And that was really a fight with, like, Rebel Without a Cause. It is one of, in the long tradition of Hollywood, what they called delinquency films, looking at juvenile delinquency and the path these kids are on. But many of those films were made for adults as kind of, we're going to show you what's going to happen to your kids if you don't pay attention. Rebel Without a Cause was one of these quote-unquote delinquency films, but it was made for teenagers. They were the audience. They were the ones being depicted. Their style of dress and their style of talk and their mannerisms were portrayed. This was not for parents. This was for the kids. So that was a radical change in terms of Hollywood at the time.
Don't you wish you could have been in a theater to watch people watch the fight scene in Rebel Without a Cause?
Right. So it was a movie for teenagers, showing them their life. And so that's part of the connection with Dean, is that he was one of them, the outsider, the new kid in town. He didn't quite fit in. He wasn't in one of the popular cliques. You know, it was one of the few Hollywood films where the leading man and lady, at least for teenagers, it wasn't the star football player or the cheerleader. It was a group of outsiders. And so when teenagers, the intended audience, saw the film, there was that connection. And I think James Dean, part of why he still lives today, is that initial connection with seeing themselves on the screen.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana State Museum's Associate Curator of Cultural History, Catherine Gould, and Communications Director Kathy Moore. The song they were trying to remember was Rock Around the Clock, made famous by Bill Haley and the Comets. Learn more, including what happens to James Dean, at Eternal James Dean. More info is at indianamuseum.org. Again, indianamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I check out two new exhibits at the Indianapolis Arts Center.
I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's holiday concerts.
And I'll find out what's so tiny at the Arts Council of Indianapolis' holiday show. Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.